Welcome to a podcast of Beyond the Book, a presentation of the not-for-profit Copyright Clearance Center. Copyright Clearance Center is the world's largest provider of copyright compliance solutions through a wide range of innovative licensing services and comprehensive educational programs for authors, publishers, and their audiences in academia, business, and research institutions. For more information about Beyond the Book and Copyright Clearance Center, please go to www.beyondthebook.com.
Let me first start by saying that I, too, reluctantly gave in to twittering, which I think is the appropriate verb. Is that right? Twittering? Am I just saying that right? And it was at the behest of my editors. And we use this in a variety of ways, but mostly I use it to promote my stories, promote stuff that I've written, promote blog posts. And this is all getting very meta, you know. This is Twitter is promoting blog posts, and it's all sorts of nonsense. But it actually works. And we look at our metrics and our statistics, and a lot of people are coming from Facebook. We have a Reason Magazine Facebook page. I don't know what happens there. Apparently, people are making friends with one another, reading stuff. Well, as long as they're reading the things that I've written, I really don't care.
But Michael, I would like to think I've been a friend of Reason for many years.
You have been, yes. But are you officially a friend on the Facebook page? Things have changed.
Right? Yeah,
So basically, and what we were speaking about the other day is I just submitted to this Twitter thing, very reluctantly. 140 characters. I tend to be a rather verbose writer. My editors are throwing, you know, fits all the time when I have my... I write a twice-monthly column for the website, separate from the magazine, which you all should be reading. If you're not, you're missing out. It's absolutely phenomenal. And it always goes over the 800 to 1,200 allotted words. So now I have someone telling me that I'm going to condense my thoughts, which tend to be these rambling sort of non sequiturs, to 140 characters. So I'm saying, what on earth is this going to be good for? Absolutely nothing. So I found out this week, after having been doing this twittering thing for a couple of months, that rather than posting pictures of your dogs and your cats and these things, there is a tremendous advantage to twittering. And that advantage right now you are seeing in the Iranian student movement. I've seen another couple of other examples too. In all of the information that we're getting now, beating the networks, beating print by, you know, I mean, we're talking hours here in the news business, it's a long time. We're finding out where people are organizing, what they're doing, how the Revolutionary Guards, how the mullahs, how the supreme leaders are responding to this. And we're getting photographs from cell phones. Now, there's a reason for this, and this is why I think Twitter's been really fantastic, is that Twitter, technologically, it's sort of decentralized. So what the Iranian government can do is they can knock down Twitter or say, you do not have access to Twitter anymore. We are blocking this website. Whereas these students were very clever. It's a great thing about, the only great thing about repressive regimes is they make people incredibly clever about technology. And they know how to get around these things. So there's all sorts of these third-party bits of software that send things either from text messages or from third-party websites up into the Twitter universe. So we're getting an enormous amount of information. That's the one point. The second point is you have, let's take a country like Cuba, which has very, very restricted internet access. And if you go to Freedom House, Amnesty International, they have been promoting a woman named Yoni Sanchez, who has been blogging her life in Havana and has been harassed by the regime and has been harassed by local police outfits. And this is all documented on her blog. Now, also to add that Iran has the third biggest per capita use of blogs. And there's a reason for this. I mean, there's a reason that there are an enormous amount of people blogging in Iran, and there's probably less people blogging in Reykjavik, for instance. I'm sure there's plenty of them, but there's an urgency to blogging when people have cut off the ordinary means of communication. And so, well, I was, you know, poo-pooing Twitter just as recently as last week. I have been using it. And now, I mean, from a journalist perspective, you have an issue. You said earlier the old dictum that if you're you have checking the sources on your mother, you're getting stuff, and is it disinformation? Well, I mean, then we get into a totally different problem. But either way, in this moment, where a lot of video, YouTube's been cut off by the authorities in Iran, but there are countless videos. CNN, by the way, who completely and utterly foolishly dropped the ball the other day. I mean, this is old media. We have, we're talking about record companies and movie studios and the rest of it being behind technology, some more behind in technology than others, definitely record companies being the furthest behind. News organizations are slowly catching up. And it's catching up in a way that is almost embarrassing. If you see Rick Sanchez on CNN at 3 o'clock, just talking about Twitter. I don't even know what he's going on about half the time. His Twitter feed's rolling. He's, they're having iReports from iReport is basically something they take off of YouTube. It's somebody who shot that they didn't have anyone clever enough to be there for. And this is the case with Iran. They were behind almost by a day on Iran, and what they're doing now is they're running YouTube footage taken by students in the streets of Iran, and I presume they're not asking any copyright permission. It might be kind of difficult to get that approval right now, but it is providing an enormous amount of needed information of what's going on in a totally closed country.
Well, in fact, I was going to just point to an article in today's New York Times that gets at this very issue here, and so it's not simply repressive regimes that are under attack here. CNN is under attack, and
yes.
It was says, untold thousands use the label CNN fail on Twitter to vent their frustration.
Yes,
over the weekend.
Yes.
It's a great example. What about the example that Reason has kind of made as much a part of what it's doing? You've got a site, reason.tv, and obviously video is critical to that, reason.com. I presume that there are podcasts and all kinds of things. How do you, as a journalist and as an editor, manage when you have so many different kinds of media that you're delivering the news and the reporting on? Back in the day, I was either a TV reporter or a print reporter. I wasn't trying to do both at the same time.
Oh, God. I should. Can I complain about this? Is this like a session where I can say we have too much work? We have too many things to do. Reason's been around for 40 years. So we had our 40th anniversary last year, but we were ahead of the curve on video stuff and on the internet. I don't know what it was Nielsen or one of these things. Of political blogs, we were, I think, in the top 20, 15, 16, 17, something like that, and we got a couple of million people a month. There's a lot of, and there's a hunger for material. And there, this, unfortunately, from a journalism perspective, creates a problem. And I know that if you're sort of under 40 and you've been sort of half of your life you've grown up on the internet, you're supposed to be an evangelist for internet technologies, full stop. I am with some reservations, and the reservations are that there's a lot of material. A colleague, Andrew Sullivan at The Atlantic, has one of the most, I think, the first or second most popular blog. And he posts something about 40 to 50 posts a day. Now, that's a lot of material. And I'm not saying that Andrew gets things wrong. I'm not saying that a lot of people get things. I mean, he works for, now, here's the interesting thing. He works for an old media organization where he has summer interns, where he has people that can fact check these things. Most people don't have that. So what the problem becomes is this desire to always be producing. And it involves a lot of overextension. I wrote a very, very, very mean thing, which I probably should regret, but I don't. A year ago, where I identified an affliction, which is amazing. I'm not a doctor, but I identified this new affliction called Google Scholars. And the Google Scholar says that, something's coming across the transom about, let's say Iran. Let's pick something slightly more. There's an election or a coup, or Georgia was a great one. Did anyone know where Tbilisi was before the invasion? I don't know. Perhaps not. But it didn't appear that they did, because what happened right then is you have all of these bloggers out there that are, so this is a huge news story. You have a major, the second superpower you know, rumbling tanks across the border into Ossetia, and did they even know what Ossetia was? So they became Google scholars for that moment. Hit Google, started saying, okay, this is what's going on in this way, and writing these very opinionated pieces about what was happening. I like to think, and you know, look, we all, when we're under pressure, deadlines, et cetera, to produce material, we all probably say things about issues that we should know more about before we open our mouths. But there is a certain bloggers that I have, and shall remain nameless, who comment on everything. Everything. And you cannot possibly have the breadth of knowledge to cut. And now, I've written a number of columns attacking old media, too. I think a lot of newspapers that are dying deserve to die. I'm sorry to say it. But I have to say, in defense of old media, is that when you have people on beats, you're reporting from countries, they're knowing what they're going on about. And I think a lot of the old media criticism of blogs is actually right. I suspect your blog is very, very focused on what your expertise is. And I find a lot of this these days from bloggers from big organizations that are covering everything from automobiles to healthcare to foreign policy. I'm not seeing it.
I love that. I'm not sure it's going to end up in the... what is it, the handbook that doctors have for all the various syndromes?
I doubt it.
But it's going to be, you know, I get my ideas in only two places. I hate to say it's a copyright claim, it's an employee, but I either think of them or I steal them. And I think I'm going to steal Google Scholar.
Yeah, steal them, that's fine. I've been trying to get this to get some traction, it's not working, so.
And in particular, what I think of as I hear you describe that is the paucity of information there, because if you think about Google, and you're all librarians, so you're familiar with research and how to research thoroughly, Google is hardly a thorough research tool. You put Tbilisi, you get the top 10 results, hardly anyone goes beyond that first page, and you don't know if they're selling you a trip to Tbilisi, which might be a bad timing if the Russians are showing up. But my point there is that in the world of the old media, a journalist would have had to have gone to something called the morgue and done his or her research on their own. And to have found things serendipitously or purposefully, but either way, what you would find in the Boston Globe morgue would be thoroughly different than what would have been in the Los Angeles Times morgue. And that matters not at all where you are, and you'll get the same results in Paris or Poughkeepsie. So,
yeah, I mean, I also want to say that I am a huge evangelist for the internet as a great research tool. I mean, half the stuff that I've been able to come across that I've been looking for, I wouldn't have been able to find in 1995, or I could have found it with great effort. That said, one of the social, not really a social media tool, but one of the phenomena that we're supposed to talk about is Wikipedia, which Reason did a cover story, a positive cover story on Jimmy Wales, the founder of Wikipedia, which I think is an absolutely phenomenal tool, but it unfortunately becomes the only tool for some people. I've seen this happen. I've seen people use it, and you can tell when they're blogging and plucking things out of Wikipedia. It doesn't mean that stuff's wrong. I mean, I have seen stuff in Wikipedia that's wrong, but I have to say that the percentage-wise, it's not that much greater of the stuff that I've seen that is wrong in newspapers, for instance. You know, newspapers issue corrections. Somebody else in Wikipedia will edit that entry. So yeah, I mean, I find that there is an enormous amount of positive resources, and I don't want to sounds like, you know, a member of the Cassandra chorus here. I mean, there are some fantastic things, and I use it every day. So,
you know, finally, and it's been a great discussion, but it's really only a start. I want to be sure that we prepare people here for your questions and your reactions to what's been said. But Michael, last question there.
Sure.
How does Reason respond to the reuse of its material in places where it may not have given permission, or
sure,
do you have a policy on that?
We don't have a hard and fast policy, much to the... it doesn't happen that much. I think that the discussion we've had today is interesting. The one thing that I would say is that we have a fairly large readership in print. You know, I think we do 60,000 or 65,000 On the web, we, as I said, we have a number of people. We do 2 million plus a month, 2.5 million a month. And for the amount that we have, the amount of material that we produce, it's surprising how little of it is actually reprinted wholesale. We do have people cutting and pasting bits of it, usually to be critical, which we encourage. We appreciate that. We enjoy it. The thing is that it's hard to put the genie back in the bottle now because news organizations gave away this stuff for free for so long, with very, very few exceptions. People tried it, Slate tried it, it didn't work. Wall Street Journal being one of the very few examples of doing Investor's Business Daily and other people that are offering specialized information. So we have so many readers and people that are on our website that I think they grew up with this stuff and came to Reason fairly recently believing that all news is free, which I think is probably another thing that we have to attack. But what we do, by the way, we have a lot of writers that write for other outlets, a lot, and we're encouraged to freelance. So if I have a piece that's in the Los Angeles Times, we contact the Los Angeles Times always and ask them if we can run the piece on our own website after a certain amount of time. And as far as I know, and I could be wrong about this, but as far as I've ever experienced in being one of the web editors at Reason, no one's ever said no. No one ever says to us, you know what? I mean, there might have been one or two examples, but most people say, yeah, sure. You can run it, just put the attribution at the bottom, this article first appeared, X, Y, and Z. Now, one final brief point. I just had something that was repurposed for free. And it was, I've had plagiarism problems where, and they were fine, took the stuff down, which is obviously a different kettle of fish. I had a repurpose thing where it was asked of us. So they asked, can we repurpose this? And I shall say it was the Huffington Post. So we said, yeah, great. You guys have enormous amounts of traffic. They're the biggest. They do 9.5 million, whereas Drudge Report used to be the king, is now around 2.5, 3. So we said, yeah, sure. The one thing that's interesting about the Huffington Post is they aggregate content. It's a big aggregation website, as you were saying, and I believe that they pay for all their stuff. They don't pay their writers. They make an enormous amount of money. They make, you know, Arianna Huffington is you know, has deep pockets. They don't pay a single writer on the website. This great liberal website that doesn't pay a single writer. That is true. They pay for the stuff that they aggregate. You write for them, you write for free. And that is where we are. That's where we are. And people do it. They want the exposure. And they'll do it for free. And it's been a very, very successful business model that's been going on for 4 years now, 3.5, 4 years. And they don't pay their writers. I mean, they have a couple reporters for them that they pay. But if you want to pitch a story to them and you want to be on the Huffington Post, you're not going to get a nickel. So.
Well, I respond to that as a former freelance journalist. I had a pretty simple business model. I ate what I killed. And that meant that I didn't write for free.
Yes.
Beyond the Book is an educational presentation of the not-for-profit Copyright Clearance Center, with conferences and seminars featuring leading authors and editors, publishing analysts, and information technology specialists. Beyond the Book is the premier source for knowledge on the latest business issues facing today's dynamic publishing industry, from initial research to final publication and beyond.